Greetings again, everyone. We had a very interesting trip out to California. Had just under 200 in the meeting out there. I think Charlie mentioned that. It looks like we're going to have a very busy 6 weeks coming up with a lot of travel in the offing, which I don't really relish. But if we're going to be out there with all of these people in these personal appearance meetings, or we call them campaigns, which is rather a misnomer, I think. They're just a one-stop, brief, one-hour sermon, like a special Sabbath visit. But hopefully we're going to plan somewhere around 30 of those in 1 year. And that's going to be a lot of travel. I was glad that he explained. I think you understood that the flat tire was after we were already on the ground. We had not even taken off yet. We were taxiing along very slowly, and we had a flat tire. It's strange, in my more than 25 years of piloting aircraft, I've had two flat tires on an airplane. They both came within a couple, 3 months. One was at the Feast of Tabernacles in a 421 up at Lake of the Ozark Strip, and I was piloting the airplane, and we were just touching down, and it blew on the rollout on the landing. And that got a little exciting there for a while, because it's a whole lot worse than an automobile. There's one benefit. You have a rudder out there, and the airplane is still sort of halfway flying. You can achieve a certain amount of directional control when an airplane blows a tire after touchdown, but even the big ones have been known to do a little partial ground loop, or go off the runway, or into the mud, or damage a wing, or something. As this turned out, we were able to get it stopped, and all we did is tear up the little mud guard on the wheel, and there was no damage to the wheel itself, so we had it replaced, and we were able to go on our way the next day. So hopefully that's the last of our tire troubles. We have a brand new tire on the King Air at the moment, so I think we've had the last problem of that nature that we'll have for some time. At least I hope so. There's a song you may remember that goes something like this. Listen very carefully to the words. Where are you going, little one, little one? Remember that one? Where are you going, my baby, my own? Turn around and you're two. Turn around and you're four. Turn around and you're a young girl going out of the door. Turn around, turn around. Turn around and you're a young girl going out of the door. That's a parent singing about how rapidly a sweet little girl baby grows up to be a young lady and says goodbye, Mom, and moves in her own apartment, or goes out the door, goes to school, goes to high school, goes to college, or something else. I want to talk today, as a result of a number of personal requests I've had along the way in personal appearance campaigns, a number of letters I've received, about our most precious personal and national resource, our children. Now, please, widows and widowers, grandparents, single people, older folk, do not turn me out. Because in a broader sense, everything I have to say applies to every one of us. To the elderly, the middle-aged, the widowed, the young couples, the single people, and the grandparents. Let's go to 1 Timothy, the third chapter, to put this in perspective while we remind ourselves, those of us who are 35, 40, 50, 55, or older, that the world has changed very dramatically in the past few decades. This know also, 2 Timothy 3:1, that in the last days perilous times shall come. For men shall be lovers of their own selves. Now that's totally egocentric. That means having only self-love, self-concern, selfishness. They shall be covetous. And of course we're all familiar with the man in the gray flannel suit climbing atop the shoulder of the boss to try to get to the top. Of people who are covetous only of double ovens and two-car garages and large mansions and summer homes and big bank accounts and fat wallets and of what they call success, which leads many people to burnout and to all sorts of hurtful and harmful diseases and mental aberrations, fits, night sweats, psychoses, neuroses, and an early grave, while they struggle to, as we say in America, succeed. They shall be boasters. You've never heard that very much, have you, except when you hear congressional speeches or when you hear politicians or oftentimes when you hear ministers, for that matter. Proud, blasphemers, there's plenty of that about. Disobedient to parents, part of the hallmark of the times in which we live. Unthankful, and certainly there's a lot of that, just plain ingratitude for the tremendous blessings we have. Unholy, without natural affection. And there's a great deal of that about, a great deal of the unnatural affection. I had some people who came up to me to try to sort of tell me I need to ease off on what I say every now and then against homosexuality, for example, not long ago, and wanted me to be a little less, perhaps, harsh, not use the word queer. I still think they're abominable queers myself, but then I was urged not to use that. But anyway, without natural affection, truce breakers. Now, you know, if you built your own home, if you've contracted with anybody, if you've had a subcontractor say, I'll be there on Thursday with a load of bricks, you know, whatever you're talking about in business, do you know of anybody who ever breaks their word? Anybody who just was, they say in East Texas, a flat-out liar. You know, that's language for a plain, unadulterated, well, they might be adulterated, a plain liar. So it says that they would be traitors. Well, I'll finish that other line. Incontinent, false accusers, incontinent, fierce, despisers of those that are good. That's commonplace in high school, of course, in the grade school playground. If you are good, if you try to be good or decent, the other little kids, like a pack of sharks, will get their little lilting song, yan, 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 you know, and they will make you into a little sissy or a fraidy cat or your chicken or this or that. And so being good is absolutely out among the kids, and that hasn't changed. I could guarantee you, a lot of the kids think that I'm of a different generation. I could almost guarantee you I can't do it, because I can't do it in the pulpit to all these 1,000, 2,000 people listening on the tape program. I could tell you the first dirty joke you ever heard, and it'll be the same one I heard in 1935. It'll be the same joke. Believe me, I've checked. People have told me, you know, later years, the first dirty joke they ever heard. Same one I heard. Kids have a subculture, and it never changes. They just keep faithfully passing it on and handing it down, and they think that's a brand new joke. Little kid, 5 years of age in kindergarten, his ears burning, his face bright red. They tell him some dirty word. He's wondering what that means, and they explain it to him, you know. But they think this is brand new. No, it's ancient, probably first told in 1847. My dad heard the same joke, and he was born in 1892. So they have a form of godliness. It says, let's go on after verse 4, traitors, heady, high-minded, lovers of pleasures, more than lovers of God, having a form of godliness, but denying the power thereof, from such turn away. Well, I won't belabor that, because that would take a lot of time to explain the kind of world we live in, but just let me say that when I was a child growing up, I never heard of drugs. Absolutely never heard of it. Even in World War II, when, as you well know, after Pearl Harbor, America, for the first time in its history, drew very tightly together. And even though there were opportunists, and there were some of the industrialists trading with the enemy, and there were black marketeers, there were people who got rich off the war, that was basically never really talked about very much. It was not well known. And by and large, the atmosphere, when I grew up in the 40s and on into the latter 40s and early 50s, was a very much cleaner, very different atmosphere. You could go back and look at the motion pictures of that era, at the heroics of the wartime movies, at the type of love stories they had that involved some of the now old actors who are, you know, gradually disappearing from the scene. And then they would have a kissing scene, and then they would fade away, you know, and that was it. You all know, without me belaboring the situation, what you have on television, what you have in motion pictures today. I never heard of drugs till I got in the Navy, and then I began to hear just a little bit about a drug called Mary Jane or marijuana. But it was probably only an isolated case of one out of thousands who ever experimented with it, and it was just not a part of the scene when I grew up. We may have heard of one girl who got pregnant out of a high school of 1,200 kids, and it was a very ugly rumor. It was never substantiated. It was such a scandal that everybody was buzzing and talking about one girl who got pregnant in a high school out of 1,200 kids that allegedly had to go to Portland, you know, to have her baby somewhere illegitimately, or had to maybe marry the guy, I don't know. But it's a completely different world in which we live today. If I were a young parent starting all over again, knowing what I know now, knowing what I know about the world out there, knowing everything that is available, the entire avalanche of pornography, all that is called, quote, entertainment, all that forces itself into your living room on television, that tries to force itself into your mind and attention via the printed page of comic books, the incredible violence, even on Saturday morning in the kiddie shows, where they're blowing each other in a red mist or sliding each other under the door after the passing road leveler, you know, runs over the kid or whatever. We think Tom and Jerry is basically harmless. But I remember back, my very first nightmare was when I was out under the street light as a boy of maybe 4.5 or 5, and some older boy told a story. It was just a little story about a haunted hospital. And he told about, you know, bloody needles. I'm not even sure the kid knew what he was talking about or that made sense. It was just about an empty hospital with cadavers and haunts and spooks and ancient elevators and old bloody knives and needles. By the time he got through with that, I woke the entire neighborhood up that night, and I've never forgotten it. It's in my mind, that picture, basically who was there, how I suffered with that dream and everything, to this day. And I'm soon to be 57. It made such an indelible impression on me. So, you know, don't anybody tell me that Tom and Jerry cartoons are completely harmless when parents wonder why a child in a playpen will pick up a toy and hurl it right into the face of another child. Or why they will pick up a play gun and make rat-a-tat noises. Or why once in a great while, as happened in Iowa several years ago, in a store operated by a family, the young toddler, not knowing that the gun was loaded, ran beneath the counter behind the cash register where his parents kept a loaded .38, pulled it out of the drawer and turned it on his mother and shot her in the stomach, and then wondered why Mommy fell to the floor dead in a pool of blood. She died rather slowly in agony from a bullet through the stomach. But the kid had seen it happen, and always in the next frame, the person who got shot got up and ran off and was perfectly all right. So the child had no concept of what it meant to point a gun at someone. Well, I get ahead of myself. But what I'm explaining is that if I were to have children in this day and age, I would be very, very concerned about how I was going to see to their protection, to their love and care, to their training, to their education, and of course to their future as much as I possibly could. Now, it would be tremendously pretentious of me to begin to think that I could cover the subject of child rearing in any sermon, let alone any 10 of them. It would be absolutely impossible. I can't do it. That is not my goal today. I merely want to refresh our memory that with regard to child training, there is a tremendous overlap into the training of all of we human beings, because after all, we are God's children, and Almighty God utilizes principles in training us and teaching us that are the same principles we ought to use in teaching and training our children. What is born, what is begotten inside of us is a very precious spiritual entity, a new creation in Jesus Christ. Now, the church, by analogy, is called the mother of us all, and God is the Father. I want us to contemplate what kind of a church it would be, and what kind of a world it would be, what kind of a Christian you would be living in such a church, if we saw revealed in the Bible the kind of, quote, gods that the Greeks worshipped, the kind of gods that were important to the Romans or the Zidonians or the Babylonians. What if our gods had lustful, orgiastic appetites? What if our gods fought? What if they raped human women? What if they conducted wars? What if they had every one of the physical lusts and appetites that pull and tug at human beings? Think about it for a minute. Because the Greeks worshiped such gods. The representations in statuary and idolatry and so on of the Greeks, the rape of Cybele, and you're familiar with a lot of Greek mythology. Their gods had these tremendous appetites. And basically, they were just like modern Christians who, listen to this, made God in their image. Because that's what modern Christendom has done. Modern Christianity has created God in man's image. Not the other way around. Now, by the same token, if you as a child had to grow up in a climate of antagonism, where mom and dad fought, where they warred against each other, etc., as millions of children have to do, today? What is it going to build into you? What kind of a handicap is there? Let's just begin at square one by admitting that there is no ideal state. There is no such thing as a perfect family. There is no such thing as a perfect parent. There never has been and never will be a perfect human family who will perfectly rear perfect children perfectly. It just won't happen. There are great masters, but there are flaws in them, right? I mean, any kind of a painting, you can pick out little flaws. I don't care how much perfection we try to achieve, we will not be perfect until we are spirit-born into God's kingdom, and we will always fall very, very short of that. When I began preaching on the subject of child-rearing back in the early 1950s, and I wrote a booklet as a result of a very lengthy master's thesis, which was about that thick and went probably 500-600 pages, in 1960, when I received my master's degree, of which this was a boiled-down little short form that went out to all the church. The child-rearing of the Radio Church of God, as it was then, later the Worldwide Church of God, became a very harsh, a very strict, a very regimented, almost status symbol, something that many people took to extremes. If I had the booklet to do over, and actually I do, and I hope to get the booklet done over, redo at some point in time, and maybe I can get Mr. Van Stinson to help me with a little bit of that work, because I think it would be a valuable project to many of our people to have a book on the subject of child rearing, to at least give most of the principles. We can't pretend to give a handbook that would result in everybody rearing children perfectly. But I think we need to understand that what happened in the church then was the tiresome swinging of the pendulum from one extreme to an opposite extreme. I took issue in the late 1950s with Benjamin Spock, with Mothercraft, with Ilg and James, with many of the writers of the child psychology books, which I want to show you a few excerpts today. And so I think that I probably put a lot more discipline and less of the other types of child training in the book than I should have. But I did put plenty of cautions, and I can show them because the book is still extant, of course. And I could go through and show you how I told people to be very, very careful about the way they trained their children, about the way they punished and spanked and so on. And in spite of that, there were many infractions. Now, I've lived, and I'm a lot older. A couple more decades have gone by. And I have seen, as a result of overly strict child training, a lot of youngsters who came up in the church, who the minute they got wings and were able to fly, you know, the minute they became mobile, the minute they could tell Dad and Mom where to get off, they just went absolutely the wrong way, or as they used to say, to hell in a handbasket, you know, is a horrible modern idiom. But they went the wrong way just as fast as they could go there. Now, don't tell me that thousands of worldwide church kids have not experimented with drugs and sex and all the rest of it, because I know better. I know what went on in college. I know exactly the problems that came in on these kids. I know the terrible handicaps they had, and I also know that they were ill-equipped to cope with it. Because like a lot of soldiers who might have been introduced into a nice, powdery, easy, wonderful environment with no machine guns, no mortars, no live ammunition, with no obstacle courses, no muddy ditches to cross, no dirty DI telling them they're a rotten, this and that and the other thing, actually turning them from a civilian into a soldier. If you took soldiers, prospective conscripts, and put them in a beautiful boys' school and no discipline, like a Montessori method, and they had free square meals and nice big thick beds and wonderful cushiony seats to sit in and nice understanding teachers and everything, then all of a sudden the war starts and you say, here, and you stick a rifle in his hand, put him out in the front lines. What kind of a soldier is he? A lot of those kids were absolutely unable to cope with what they found in the world, because the difference between the false environment of church and the environment of the families in the church at that time and what the kids had in school, it just conflicted. They couldn't handle it. And a lot of parents chose to blot that out of their mind. They thought that, well, if we bring the kid to church and put them on the blanket, put them down in the back and tell them, shut up and be still and don't make any noise, because if you make noise, that'll embarrass Mom. and have embarrassed his mom, that's, you know, a breach of status. And mom and dad look real bad because we're in a bad status with them up here mouthing away about child rearing if we've got disobedient children. Well, I've seen parents at the Feast of Tabernacles reach up and absolutely take a nubbin of flesh out of a kid. You know, just pinch them. I've seen them thump them on the head. I've seen them twist their clothes, grab their arm, everything. When the kid's kind of squirming, well, I get tired. I squirm in my chair. So I thought I saw things go to an extreme. We began at the other extreme. When I first began preaching on the subject, Benny remembers it well. He was only about 12 at the time and was in the audience. And we had absolute chaos at the feast up in Big Sandy. I mean, the parents couldn't control the children, and they were just running and screaming and shouting, and parents were running off after the kids, trying to keep them from drowning in a baptismal pool, climbing trees, letting the air out of tires, getting into minor wars and fights, and destroying the furniture, and basically just total mayhem reigned. I had to speak over the din. When I first preached, I had to preach and make it clear. I mean, you mothers way outside in the parking lot who can't come in here because your kids won't let you. You know, I mean you out there. I remember saying that in my sermon. Well, that was the first time in the history of the Church of God that any minister was ever given a standing ovation. That is the first time. It began the practice, I guess. Later on, when people appreciated sermons, they used to applaud. Maybe they still do. I don't think they should. But it was such a spontaneous burst of enthusiasm because just terrible, untrained, wild children were causing such a mess in services, nobody could hear or think, that really they were so relieved to hear somebody tackle the problem head on, they just stood up and applauded. In the ensuing years, we went to an opposite extreme, and we drove our children underground. We made Sabbath a terrible burden. Sabbath was a day that was to be, it was just abhorred. It was a day that was absolutely resented by children. Now, in a way, I grew up that way, but I found my ways to get around it, as I've told before, as I was a kid. And thankfully, my parents weren't as strict as maybe you might think they were. My mom especially was very understanding, and she allowed me to do things that were a sort of an outlet for my energies and so on. And I did not ever resent my mom or resent what she stood for. I didn't necessarily accept it or understand it. I did resent my father as an authoritarian figure, and that's because of a difference in the way that they tried to handle me. Father, my dad, was a disciplinarian, and mom was the one who showed love and forgiveness, and that's wrong. Shouldn't have been that way. Let's get into it then a little bit today. I want to, first of all, ask the question, what is a child? Now, that's a dumb question. Everybody knows what a child is. It is the human replica of its parents. It is a child that is brought forth into this earth by human reproduction, and a very wonderful and a desirable and a beautiful thing it is to have a little child made in our own image. I asked that question in my booklet, and way back when I was doing that work from 1958 to 1960 for my master's thesis, for the simple reason that the child psychologists didn't seem to know. They didn't seem to know how to train a child. They knew, I guess, that you can train a parrot. They knew you can train a dog. They knew you could train a whale or a dolphin. They knew that even a little slip of a girl sitting astride a massive elephant with a huge cane in her hand could make the elephant stand around on one leg or dance or kneel or pick her up with the trunk and put her on its back, as we've seen in circuses. And they expect that you could train an animal. But they didn't think that you could train a child. I remember at about that time reading a story about the training of young falcons. And since that time, I have two sons now that are into falconry, and they are training red-tailed hawks. And they actually go out and hunt with them. And the way they train them is exactly the way in which children must be trained, at least in principle, just the principles that are at work, that have to do with consistency, with where their food and their shelter and their protection comes from, and that has to do with the kind of insistent, repetitious, and consistent training that they give these birds. But you know, the child psychologists didn't know what a child really was, and so they began to try to teach people how to train these children. When my wife and I were first married, a guy came to our door representing a national magazine called Mothercraft. And I was quite angry, and later on I was very thankful, that she had subscribed to it and had bought this salesman's spiel, you know, a great thick book about that thick with a red cover called Mothercraft. No, I'm sorry, it was Parents Magazine. Parents Magazine had a book which they gave you as a gift, or maybe you paid for it if you subscribed to the magazine, called Mothercraft. I began reading through that book, and that was what triggered my research into child psychology and my master's thesis on the subject of child rearing. I want you to listen to this idea that was out of a book called Child Behavior on page 22 by Ilgen Ames to give you an idea of the kind of teaching I ran across, which is to some degree stamped today, although I think in schools a little bit of the pendulum has swung back the other way and there is a little bit more discipline available. I quote, "The 18-monther walks down a one-way street, though this one-way street can be readily reversed. And this street, more often than not, seems to lead in a direction exactly opposite to that which the adult has in mind. As to, come here, dear, he either stands still or runs in the opposite direction. He may even like to walk backwards to show his rebellion, you see. Ask him to put something in a wastebasket, and he is more likely to empty out what is already in it. Hold out your hand for the cup which he has just drained, and he will drop it onto the floor. Give him a second sock to put on, and he will more than likely remove the one which is already on his foot. His enjoyment of the opposite may be the reason why it works so well. Listen to this advice. If he is running away from you, and I've seen this done in stores and restaurants, to say, bye-bye, and walk away from him. Then he may, no guarantee, come running. Not only does he not come when called, he seldom obeys any verbal command. No is his chief word." Now that's like telling a parent, you take this strange thing looking like RD2D or whatever out of a box, right? It comes in a box and it has an instruction label with it. Did I say that wrong, or you didn't know that I knew those initials? I read them in a book. I didn't see the movie. I saw one with Ron Dart, and wish I hadn't. I saw part of it. Anyway, here comes this robot, see? Now, this robot is wired this way. And so they tell you that's exactly what you expect. So here, bewildered young parents, and they're reading this book. Well, they've got to know, because they've studied hundreds and hundreds of these kids, and they've been behind double glass and observed them when the kids didn't know they were looking. And they watched them play, and they had the room bugged, and they heard what they said, and on, so they were taking notes and these little Einsteins running around. And if they were playing in the toilet, they thought maybe they're going to be a great sculptor someday. So just let them play. They didn't care. So, now they stated that these 18-monthers just did that because they're 18 months of age. I got to give you another one. 2.5 years. This is an age about which parents may need warning, because so much that the child now does naturally, almost inevitably, is directly contrary to what his parents would like to have him do. The 2.5-year-old is not temperamentally an easily adaptable member of any social group. The change in behavior which takes place between 2 and 2.5 can be rather overwhelming. Now, as if the 18-month, parents haven't had a horrible thing to contend with, now they're told, wait till this kid changes from 2 to 2.5. Perhaps to the child as well as to the adults who surround him, 2.5 is a peak age of disequilibrium. Parents often say they can't do a thing with a child of this age. First of all, 2.5 is rigid and inflexible. He wants exactly what he wants when he wants it. He cannot adapt, give in, wait a little while. Everything has to be done just so, not by him, for him. Everything has to be in the right place. He considers its proper place, even if you consider it's the wrong place for the goldfish bowl upside down on the living room rug, right? If you consider that the cereal bowl, it is wrong for the full hot cereal bowl to be on little brother's head, upside down, he considers that as its proper place, right? For any domestic routine, he, this little child, sets up a rigid sequence of events which must follow each other always in the same manner. Now here we're assured just like you get the robot, and here's the instruction sheet, that any 2.5-year-old child is going to function this way. Now, what they did is they put these kids in like a bunch of little apes, and they stood off through double glass in all these various centers and Montessori schools and all of that, and watched them dabble. And they watched them develop without any parental training, without any discipline, without anything to curtail their little activities. And they said, now that's the way they are. It'd be like getting a bunch of apes from West Togoland in the rainforest, putting them in a cage, and just throwing food in every now and then, standing off and watch them scratch. And say, well, they scratch, and they pick, lice and pop them and eat them. And they do all sorts of crazy things, and people will stay around among these apes and watch the way they behave. But nobody interferes with them. Now the authors continue. Second, he is extremely domineering and demanding. He must give the orders. He must make the decisions. If he decides, mummy do, daddy will not be accepted as a substitute. 2.5 is an age of violent emotions. There is little modulation to the emotional life of the child at this age. Furthermore, it is an age of opposite extremes. Total all these characteristics together, and you have a child who is not easy to deal with. Boy, I'll guarantee you, if that's what you're going to expect at 2.5, how would you like to have your employee in the office act that way? How would you like to have somebody in a restaurant you meet how about somebody in traffic down here driving an automobile? For an adult to act that way, he'd be in jail, like tomorrow, but not a kid. Vigorous, enthusiastic, energetic, the typical 2.5 may be, but he is not an easy person to have around the house. However, mothers will find that great patience, a real understanding of the difficulties of the age, and a willingness to use endless techniques to get around rigidities and rituals and stubbornness will help get through the time till the difficult 2.5 turns 3. Magic. Third birthday, you blow out 3 candles, everything's a child's fine now. Uh-oh, no it isn't. Wait till you hear what they got in store for you when the child is 3. Well, I won't read on, but it's unbelievable. Now, my own kids apparently didn't know that they were supposed to go through all these stages. They didn't go through these stages. They just didn't experience any of them. Now, I'm the quickest to confess that I may have been a little bit too much on the side of discipline and not enough on the other side. But you know, there are scriptures in the Bible that tell us a little bit about that, and I want to quote a couple of them because I think they're very, very important. Over in Proverbs, the 23rd chapter and verse 13, Proverbs 23 and verse 13, it tells us that when we withhold correction from a child, we are withholding something very, very important. That's Proverbs 23 and verse 15. And I want to explain one Hebrew word here, which has, I think, been misunderstood. Let's read in verse 13. Withhold not correction from the child, for if you beat him with the rod, he shall not die. Now, that's a terrible, unfortunate translation. The word beat in the Hebrew language it's naka, N-A-K-A-H, and it means to strike either lightly or severely. It doesn't have anything to do with beating. And you read the word rod, and you think, well, Dad grabbed a curtain rod off here and took the drapes off of it, about that big around, made of brass, and starts breaking the child's legs. And people have made real, I won't go into the story of child abuse, which we could talk hours about, of child torture and of child murder that is common and extant in our society today, where parents have, quote, punished, end quote, out of their own frustration, out of their own anger, out of their own rage, which should never have been done. But the meaning of this term is really to strike lightly, and the word rod really means a little willow, or like a little willowy switch. Now, careful, because a parent could actually break the skin and could injure a child with a switch. And I got to give all these precautions because I remember so well that people would run to an opposite extreme with anything that had to do with any discipline and would actually injure a child back in those early years. I remember one man that was actually whipping a child with a coat hanger. Now, you know that a coat hanger is going to break the skin. I'd like to grab that parent. I ran down there, and they called me to come and try to help them with the child. When I got there, the child was actually bleeding. Now, the man was an ignorant fool, and he had actually grown up breaking horses. And this ignorant idiot thought that the way to break the child is the same way he broke a horse. I'd like to got more than that coat hanger and taken it to him. Instead, I lashed him with my words and let him know what I thought of any parent that could do that to his own child. He decided the child was not going to cry. He'd strike the child cried, he told the child to shut up. The child didn't, he strike him again. You know, you got to, what you got to do to a person like this is literally, I should have probably taken an axe handle, knocked him down, and said, now, watch what happens when I hit you on the nose. It's cause and effect. Hit blood. You see what happens? Now watch. When you hit the child, he cries. That's cause and effect. You're the one making him cry. Don't try to make him shut up. But I couldn't do that. I was a minister. I wanted to, but I couldn't do it. For you shall beat him, that's very bad language, you shall spank him with the rod, a switch or something like that, and shall deliver his nephesh, his life, his being, from Sheol, the grave, from death or from Gehenna. There are many, many scriptures in Proverbs, I covered practically all of them in my booklet, that have to do with discipline, with the right and the proper kind of discipline. But the balance you'll receive on it is found in the 12th chapter of the book of Hebrews, and beginning in verse 5. You have forgotten the exhortation which speaks unto you as unto children. My son, despise not thou the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when you are rebuked of him. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens, and scourges every son whom he receives. If you endure chastening, God deals with you as with sons. For what son is he whom the Father chasteneth not? But if you be without chastisement, whereof all are partakers, then are ye bastards and not sons, illegitimate children and not sons. Because fathers don't go down the block to punish somebody else's children, as often as they might like to. They punish their own because they love them. Furthermore, we have had fathers of our flesh which corrected us, and we gave them reverence. Shall we not much rather be in subjection unto the Father of spirits and live? For they verily for a few days chastened us after their own pleasure, but he for our profit, that we might be partakers of his holiness. Now no chastening for the present seems to be joyous, but grievous for the present. Afterwards, nevertheless, it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness unto them which are exercised thereby. The kind of punishment I almost always saw was the wrong kind. I think there were a couple of three times, maybe more, that my wife and I punished, and punished with the wrong kind of punishment. But by and large, most of the time, it was the right kind. Now let me show you a little bit by a few principles on the subject of punishment, of discipline, where children are concerned. To be effective, discipline, first and always, must be done, as we see right here in Hebrews 12, in love. Now, what does that say? That says that the emotion flowing from the parent to the child is a very full, calm, beautiful emotion that takes into account all the things that that child means to the parent. Of the childbirth, the pains, the wonderful little precious life that this child, male or female, is to you, of all the family and the background, of the food, clothing, and shelter you labor so hard to provide, of the wonderful life that you want for them in the future. And your total emotion is one of outflowing concern, tenderness, gentleness, and love, the kind of love which means that a parent would be willing to die for that child. Most of the time, most parents punish in anger. They punish in or out of frustration. They punish because the child has pushed them to the breaking point where they have run out of patience. Most of the time, they do not punish from these other great emotions that we are seeing here in Hebrews 12 that God has toward us. God so loved us, he gave his only begotten Son. While we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. I'm reminded of the tragic accident that occurred up by Lake Shasta in California one time, where they found the rigid, dead body of a mother who had been driving an automobile and had gone off the turn there and had tumbled into the lake. As the car that had crashed was filling with water, the crush of the water, the way it was lying there, had prevented the mother from getting out, and only the top was visible and part of one window. That mother could not get out. She was trapped, but she had gotten that window down far enough to get her child to safety. And her little child was clinging to the top with the mother's hand, absolutely frozen in death, rigid, hanging on to that child's arm, where the mother's last act had been to save the child and had died to save her own daughter. Now, that kind of an emotion actually dwells within most parents, not all. Two times in the last week in one of the big eastern cities, I heard on news of little babies, one of which was found in a garbage can, where single parents having illegitimate children have taken their own babies and just tossed them away like trash. Now, I won't belabor that, because in the world, by and large, with all the single parents there are, with all the illegitimate children, and there are millions of them, and with a complete breakdown in morality and the disintegration of the family structure in the United States of America, there is a tremendous amount of that that goes on. That does not mean that we in God's church are not absolutely required to be good, wonderful, loving trainers, teachers, educators, protectors, providers of our own children. Let me show you something in 1 Timothy, the third chapter, speaking of the qualifications for a minister. It says of bishops, meaning a presbyter or an elder, an ordained minister of the church, in 1 Timothy 3:4, that he is to be one that ruleth well his own house, having his children in subjection with all gravity. That does not mean terror. It does not mean fear. It does not mean in terrible awe and fear of him. It means in docile, humble, loving subjection. Doesn't convey anything negative, but everything positive. For if a man know not how to rule his own house, how shall he take care of? You see, take care of and rule are the same. Oversee, care for, like a shepherd that gently leads the flock, does not beat them or drive them. How shall he take care of the church of God? Not a novice, lest being lifted up with pride he fall into condemnation of the devil. Notice that even deacons, it says in verse 12, are to be the husbands of one wife, ruling their children in their own house as well. So, correctly training children is actually a qualification for the ministry. And without that, a person simply should not be a minister. I used to be amazed at men in the ministry in a worldwide church, because when that was one reason I wanted to do away with some of the special segments at Feast of Tabernacles up near the front, because some of the noisiest parts of the tabernacle were where the ministers' kids were. I've looked in dumbfounded amazement at some of those ministers that would show up, 3, 4, 5 little children, and absolutely uncontrollable. I remember one particular family was over at my house in South Orange Grove one time, and a mother says, "Now," and he screamed out the name, "Don't you go near that pool!" The kid promptly took about 3 steps backward and fell in the pool. I'm in a business suit, and I'm wearing a vest wallet. I jump in the pool. The kid's floating like this. He can't swim. He's maybe 2 years of age, and he's slowly sinking near the diving board. I dive into the pool with my suit, shoes, and everything on. Go down, grab the kid, and bring him up, and he just thinks it's a lark. He's smiling in a minute. Mother's out there absolutely frantic. I'm standing there with my sodden clothes on. Of course, they're sort of apologetic, but I didn't think quite as apologetic as I should have been. But it was rather interesting. I mean, some of these kids can really, really be something else. Well, I've seen a lot of them. I'm talking about a ministerial family in that case, by the way. So, let me just go back to a couple of points I want to bring up, and I've got to hurry here. Child training begins at birth. In a way, it may even begin before birth, because I know that wrong diets and wrong habits and smoking and drugs and all of that can do terrible things to a fetus. It may not be so well known what bickering, a loud environment, loud music, secondhand smoke, staying up late, or a wrong diet and so on, the lack of a stable environment can do to a developing fetus, but they do say the children that have developed in the womb in a placid, quiet environment are children who can, sleep well and on and on and on. And children that have come from a real noisy environment are children that are very nervous and tired easily and fussy and so on. I don't know about that. I've never seen the studies. The act of punishing a child is an act and must at all times be an act of love. Discipline is an act of love. It is not an act of anger or of hatred or of spite. It is not for a parent to try to get back at a child, and to be effective, discipline must be many, many things, but first of all, it must always be administered very carefully, very patiently, very deliberately, and with a complete understanding and even an explanation to the child as to why the discipline is being administered, and then with immediate love and tender forgiveness by the parent who administers the discipline. Now let's get into some reasons why. It's got to be, first of all, consistent. You cannot punish on one occasion for some infraction and then let the same infraction go several other times. You'll just confuse the daylights out of a child. You must be absolutely consistent. So don't tell a child you're going to punish the child for this and that unless you really intend to do it. How many times have you heard a parent, how many times have you parents said, how many times do I have to tell you to do thus and such and so and so? Well, the kid shoots back, oh, how about 347, Mom? You just started, you're on number five, you know, we can wear the guess out. But if the kid had come up with something like that, it would show you what you're talking about. But I've heard parents do that all of my life. How many times, young man, have I got to tell you to do that? Well, just, you know, 347 more, Mom, and I might get around to it. But parents will go on with that. Or they'll say, young man, blah, 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 do you hear me? And he could turn around and say, yes, and so do the neighbors. You know, everybody hears it. But parents get all frustrated, and they use these silly slogans. We repeat them over and over again to our children, which are so absolutely useless. I like the one where the parent has the kid, and the kid is just absolutely screaming. And he's bouncing the kid, or she is, you know, bouncing, going, shh. And so the kid grows up with a fear of gas jets, you know. He doesn't know what in the world this sound means. A child doesn't know what that means. Now, we adults think that means either the first part of a horrible word or be quiet. A child doesn't know that. Do you know that a child thinks shh means I get to bob? See, if you got the child on your knee and you're going shh, and the child says, that's a lot of fun. I'm going to cry some more because Mom's saying, shh, time to get bobbed up and down on her knee. But the child doesn't know that shh means, you know, what the parent is doing, let's face it, is doing that for the benefit of the other people who can't hear the sermon. The parent is playing a game. The parent is saying, I'm telling my kid to shut up. And the kid is not shutting up because the parent doesn't know how to shut up the kid. What should the parent do? I know the children are going to cry, and they're going to cry in services, and that doesn't bother me in the least because I'm sure I used to do it. My dad used to take out a great big thick green pen that he had that a child couldn't get apart, you know, or a pencil, I guess it was, and it was large enough so it couldn't be swallowed, and at least I hope so. But anyway, he would actually come down out of the pulpit. I've seen him do it with a child that was just screaming its head off and could not be pacified, and he said he never failed to see it work, and I've seen him do it many times up in Eugene, Oregon. Come right down out of the pulpit and say, here, let the little darling have this, you know, and the little kid reach up and grab that big green pen and start to look at it and then gnaw on it. I don't know how many babies cut their teeth on my dad's big green pen. But he would do anything to go out of his way to help that mother. But, you know, he didn't embarrass them. He didn't say, take that child out of here and whip the devil out of them or something like that. He didn't at all. So I understand that, and I don't want to get anybody paranoid. The purpose of this sermon is not to get all you people with sweet little babies, we got so many of them here, I'm expecting a grandchild of my own, to be embarrassed if your child cries. Please don't do that. Don't take this sermon that way. It isn't meant to, you know, produce that result. They are going to get tired. They are going to cry. I understand that. We all understand that. It is inevitable. When they do, just quietly take them and go somewhere, feed them, change them, love them. If it's a severe case, you detect an attitude and you think you need to spank them, that's your responsibility, not mine. But for pity's sake, don't be embarrassed for the rest of us, because they are going to cry and they are going to fuss and cry in services from time to time. Now, to be effective, discipline must be tempered with love and forgiveness. I think the more you explain to a child, perhaps, you know, right then and there, it seems a little superfluous, and I'm going to have to punish you because you did this and such. But the better off you are, and then to immediately love them and to forgive them instantly afterward. But I've seen so many parents that say, you stupid oaf, can't you do anything right? Or, now look what you've done. The mother breaks into tears because the child has broke some bric-a-brac or something like that, or killed the goldfish, you know, maybe ate them. turned over the bowl and maybe stepped on, skidded on the goldfish on the carpet. You've seen this happen in some homes. How long has that fish been there? Well, I don't know, but he's got one last twitch in him, you know, and you find he's all covered with lint. Have you ever found a goldfish covered with lint? I have, on the living room rug, you know. Now, I'm not talking about my own sons. I mean in other people's home, my sister's home. I don't think we had goldfish, and if we did, my kids never did turn over the bowl. I know people have killed a canary. You know, little kids chase a canary back and forth till the canary just falls exhausted, lying there like this. Parent comes home and says, "What happened to the canary?" "The cat did it," you know. But the kids are poking at the canary. You have to explain it, and then when you do punish them, you have to forgive them. And remember, very important, any parent who punishes must be the parent to forgive. Don't let happen what happened in my family between my father and mother. Dad was the disciplinarian. When he punished, I ran to Mom, and Mom was wrong, bless her sweet heart, but she then, you know, cuddled me and loved me, and that told me, gave me some very false signals. See, you run from Dad, and you go to Mom. Bad news. Very bad news. Don't ever do it. Whichever parent, and both ought to share equally in punishment. So neither one of them ever appears. You ought to divide it absolutely 50-50 if you can. So neither one of them ever appears to be the bad guy, see? Divide it equally, and the one who punishes should be the one to forgive, the one to cuddle and to hug and to love, and so on. And, of course, when you punish, remember that that is not the only way to get what you need out of a child. There are gifts, there are rewards, there are prizes, there are goals to set in terms of even posting up a little thing about making up the bed or picking up the toy box or whatever on the wall, giving little stars like they do in school. There are rewards like special desserts if they're not bad for them or rot their teeth out. There are rewards like going to, you know, take a ride on the merry-go-round or whatever there is. There are ways to teach a child which can be incentives. There can be deprivation of privilege. I would never say isolation is a good way to train a child. Some people do. They say stick them in a closet, you know. It was very embarrassing to me as a kid in grade school to stand with my nose in a little circle on the blackboard. That always used to just bug me to death because I knew what the rest of the kids thought about this jackass up there pressing his nose into the blackboard. That used to drive me crazy, and I don't think that the teachers should have done that. They, I think, in school would tend to go out of their way to humiliate the child in front of the other kids, which is not a good method of child training at all. To try to embarrass a child to death just makes you hate the other kids and makes you hate the teacher. Mrs. Armsworthy, she lived up to her name. I once saw her yank John Hardcastle right off the floor with a stiff arm by his hair and take him out into the hallway, and it was a thin wall, and we heard his screams all the way from the coat locker out there, and his feet never touched the floor. He just danced all the way out. And I mean, when I went to grade school in the 1930s, if you acted up, you got a ruler. The least of your worries was a ruler on the back of your hand. And the worst was a real working over in a coat locker with Mrs. Armsworthy. So you kids got it easy today. You know, you got teachers today who go to the principal. They go to the principal and they go to jail if they lay a hand on a lot of little kids in school today. No parent who is angry ever has any business punishing a child, period. End of story. No parent who is upset or is getting even or is irritated or tired or embarrassed because of other adults has any business punishing a child. Only a parent who realizes they've got here a great masterpiece, that great masterpieces are done and are painted with great careful skill, and that each stroke is with painstaking effort, and that each time you enter into a training situation with a child, it is infinitely of more value to that child than 100 good square meals. It's infinitely of more value than 6 years of new school clothes. It is of infinitely more value than all types of other training you can give, because it is the kind of loving correction which is building into a child. And the first 5 years are more important than all the rest of them put together. The first 10 years are more important than all the rest of them put together. The first 15 years, of course, are absolutely, that's it, you're through. You're over. Whatever the factory, the parent is the mold, you know, and the factory has produced by that time will be known to all, and there's little, if anything, you can ever do to change it. And oftentimes parents wait until the kid is about 7 years of age and then try to discipline. Or wait until they're a teenage and then try to get the control they never had when the child was two. It's impossible. You just can't do it. I simply insist that our children are such a precious resource. They're such a fabulous part of us that when we love and when we discipline, when we forgive, when we train our children, we are carefully building the ultimate masterpiece of all of the universe, which is human character. A child who grows up with values, who has the respect for the rights of others, awareness of the needs of others, respect for others' property, consciousness of the value of certain material things as well as spiritual and philosophical or moral values. I have made many mistakes as a parent, but one thing is sure. I am reaping and have been reaping for many years now with my wife the results, however ineffective, however flawed, of the kind of child-rearing we practiced when our children were growing up, so that with my sons, all of them in their 30s, we have a fantastic, close, warm, loving relationship. My sons are with me, and sure enough, God says, if you train them in the way they should go when they are young, surely when they are old, they will not depart from it. That reward, having my children, having my son as a young expectant father sitting here, I'll tell you, I would die for it every Tuesday at 10 o'clock as often as God required it. It is of such value, it's worth more than every human possession I have ever accumulated. There is nothing more precious